there is this incredible sleuthing by these investigators where they find a guy who had served at Firebase Shkin in 2003. That's where this ambush took place. And he put them on to a different guy who had a footlocker full of Battlefield souvenirs. And they said, you need to send us that stuff right now. He was very reluctant to do so, the soldier, but they said, you got to do it right now. And so he turned all the stuff over. And then ultimately it goes from the investigators' offices to Quantico, to the FBI headquarters in Quantico. You meet a fingerprint analyst. Again, so many of these characters are people you would see in a TV show or a movie. This woman, Nicole Bagley, who is a forensic scientist, she has dyed red hair and a nose ring and tats on her neck. And she's, you know, just this very colorful character. And she's the fingerprint analyst, and she gets all this stuff in the mail. And along with, at this point, obviously Spin Ghoul's in custody, along with his fingerprints. And it's up to her to see if she can find any fingerprint evidence on any of this stuff from the battlefield, so they can prove Spin Ghoul was actually at the scene of the battle.
That is Jake Tapper from CNN talking about the subject of his new book. Really fascinating read. It's about the capture of a terrorist, Spin Ghoul, and the conversation is just really gripping and really interesting. How they convicted this guy, they were able to do this amazing detective work to figure out tying him to these terrorist acts. A really great listen coming up in a second. Before we get to that, you see me on tour December 12th and 13th. I'll be at the House of Comedy in Scottsdale, Arizona, and February 11th to the 14th, I'll be in Royal Oak, Michigan, just outside of Detroit, the Comedy Castle, great club. Love going to both these clubs. And putting Permission to Speak online, you can see that on Patreon and on my YouTube channel. Follow me at Paul Mercurio, and we got more tour dates coming up. So check out my website, paulmercurio.com. All right, enjoy Jake Tapper, everybody.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. My guest this week is the lead anchor at CNN in Washington, D.C., host of The Lead with Jake Tapper and also State of the Union. Jake Tapper, great to have you on the show.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much, Paul.
Yeah, absolutely. You are a best-selling author as well, and you have a new book out, Race Against Terror, Chasing an Al-Qaeda Killer at the Dawn of the Forever War. And it focuses on Spin Ghoul, a little-known terrorist that whose capture and prosecution really had sort of long-ranging effects. Give a quick synopsis of his backstory as the central figure in the book, and we can get into more detail on the book.
So the book is basically about the sleuthing. What happens is this guy, this Al-Qaeda operative, gets picked up by the Italians during the Arab Spring, and they call the Americans, the Italians, and say, we have this guy, he claims to be an Al-Qaeda operative. We don't know if you've ever heard of him. The Americans have. And they go, the Americans, to Italy to hear his court trial. And when it's over, the Italians are like, great, take him. But the Americans can't take him. They have to prove a case because it's the Obama years and Obama wants to prosecute terrorists in criminal court. So what follows is just this incredible story, and it's a true story, of sleuthing, of trying to track down evidence against this Al-Qaeda operative who killed Americans in Afghanistan in 2003. And tried to blow up the U.S. embassy in Nigeria a few years after that. And it's really, so it's, for me, it was interesting when I first heard the story from one of the investigators, because I love those shows like CSI and Cold Case and Law and Order. When I love hearing about how the clues are, how the evidence is found to put somebody away. And so that's what really was interesting to me about it. Spin Ghoul's story is he was raised in Saudi Arabia and just recruited into terrorism, as happens so often, to young men in that part of the world.
It's interesting because in the book, you sort of, there's some really great detail, and the book is really three genres for me. It's it's historical nonfiction, it's a thriller, as you just mentioned, because the Italians are holding him for a certain period of time. So there is this tension because the Italians are still skeptical of the war on terror, and the U.S.'s war on terror. And it's also educational. We could talk about that in a minute, but explain the tension regarding the Italians and the Americans and his capture and being held.
So you got it exactly right. By 2011, even our European allies were really losing patience with the United States and the way that we had been waging the war on terror. They were fed up with Gitmo and enhanced interrogation, or what they called torture. They were fed up with terrorists having this, you know, extra legal definition. They were called enemy combatants and just sent to Gitmo. And they just thought the United States was not upholding basic human rights. And in fact, right before the Italians picked this guy up, or this terrorist up, and reached out to the U.S., they had been, the Italians had put a bunch of Americans on trial, a bunch of CIA operatives and military officials for what they called kidnapping, what the U.S. called extraordinary rendition, which is when the U.S. would go into another country, take a terrorist and whisk him out of the country, an accused terrorist, I should say. This was an Egyptian cleric who the Americans in like 2002 basically abducted. And so right before this happened, the Italian justice system was going after the U.S. for kidnapping and convicting him. So that really hurt the effort of the U.S. to wage the war on terror, because, you know, without our allies, we don't have cooperation the way we need to. And in fact, the Italians would only turn over Spin Ghoul if the Americans pledged he wouldn't be taken to Gitmo, he wouldn't be tried in a criminal court, and the death penalty had to be taken off the table. So that also complicated the task of these prosecutors and made it even more difficult for them, because then they had to really prove a criminal case the way that you would prove a criminal case, you know, for a murder in Queens. Right. You had to prove it, except this was American service members who had been killed on the battlefield in Afghanistan in 2003. So 8 years before.
Unbelievable.
That made it more challenging. Yeah.
Yeah. And they found a Quran with his fingerprints on it in the battlefield. It seemed really incredible, like the level of detail. And when you consider in the context that this is sort of a worldwide crime scene, right, on some level, or, yeah, you know, worlds away. Talk about sort of how they did the sleuthing and what were, you know, talk about the Quran for a second and what they found, that how they found that and just how they built this case in criminal court.
So there is this incredible compilation of facts when it comes to terrorists and battles. It's called DOMEX, and it has to do, it's the domestic media database that you have to have like a special classification to have access to. And they were, once they figured out which battle it was that Spin Ghoul had participated in, which ambush it was on American service members, they were able to use some of these interesting characters in the military and that I introduce in the book to try to figure out what evidence is there, what battlefield evidence is there. And then once they saw photographs of things that had been taken from the battlefield, they then had to try to track all those items down. And there is this, like I said, this incredible sleuthing by these investigators where they find a guy who had served at Firebase Shkin in 2003. That's where this ambush took place. And he put them on to a different guy who had a footlocker full of battlefield souvenirs. And they said, you need to send us that stuff right now. He was very reluctant to do so, the soldier, but they said, you got to do it right now. And so he turned all the stuff over. And then ultimately it goes from the investigators' offices to Quantico, to the FBI headquarters in Quantico. You meet a fingerprint analyst. Again, so many of these characters are people you would see in a TV show or a movie. This woman, Nicole Bagley, who is a forensic scientist, she has dyed red hair and a nose ring and tats on her neck. And she's, you know, just this very colorful character. Mm. And she's the fingerprint analyst, and she gets all this stuff in the mail. And along with, at this point, obviously Spin Ghoul's in custody along with his fingerprints. And it's up to her to see if she can find any fingerprint evidence on any of this, any of this stuff from the battlefield, so they can prove Spin Ghoul was actually at the scene of the battle. And that's, I don't want to spoil anything, but I mean, that's one of the many ways, that they prove this case. When I was told this story by, I had a paintball birthday party for my son when he turned 13. So this is 3 years ago. And one of the dads kind of like we struck up a conversation, and he was one of the prosecutors. He told me this story just as a party story, like one of the greatest, you know, interesting stories of his career.
Right.
And I was just like, oh my God, this is so interesting, because how they figured out which battle it was and how they got the evidence and how they tracked down all the witnesses was just so interesting.
Well, I'll tell you, if you don't really delve into the book and you scan it, just read a blurb or whatever, you go, oh, well, this is fiction, right? But in part because the characters feel made up, but they're right. So colorful. You feel at one point like you're watching an episode of Law and Order where like the cops got the guy in the alley and go, look, we know you got the evidence. You give us the evidence, we'll get you off the thing or whatever. And it's like, no, but even, and it just has that feel.
Some of the characters, Paul, like for instance, like if I were handing into you a novel and I had on this case, I had two different FBI agents. Both of them were Muslim women. One of them black from Baltimore and the other one from the former Balkans. You would say, Jake, that's a little much, you know, but it's, yeah. but it's true. It's yeah. true. And so many of the characters in this book are like that. It's part of the great American mosaic we have. But also I tried, you know, I've written a few novels and I tried to take some of the writing lessons that I learned and apply it to this. So it would read like a novel. So it would read like a thriller.
Well, you know, his journey alone is a book, right? Like, yeah. you know, and I don't want to call it radicalization because it's really interesting. There's a quote in the book about Svengoolie. You say he wasn't radicalized as much as romance by stories of men with a higher purpose fighting for their religion and their people. It instilled in him a determination to fight and to kill. And I had never seen a terrorist characterized like that. And is it fair to say that it almost didn't matter what the cause was? He just wanted to be a fighter because of whatever his psychology was?
It's possible. I mean, I think when you look at the radicalization of young men in the world, whether it's, you know, Charlie Kirk's killer in Utah or right. Luigi Mangione, who killed the United Healthcare executive, or Svengoolie and people who do Islamic terrorists, I think a lot of times they're lost young men, don't know what to do with their lives, and they are given a purpose from some sort of recruiter. And they also have this sense of grandiosity. That's one of the things that's definitely true with Svengoolie and some of the other guys I mentioned. They have this sense that they are these historical figures having a date with destiny. You know, in reality, they're just murderers. They're just common thugs that have just been convinced that their acts of violence are being done in the name of something. But I do think that it's tough to say, like, what could he have been radicalized to join the Saudi army? Could he have been radicalized to become a spy? Could he have been radicalized, you know, in a different world to become a far right winger or a far left winger in the United States? I don't know. But it's an interesting question.
Yeah. You mentioned there's a magazine he's handed in 2000 that he has this pretty, you know, from our perspective, we're not terrorists, so obviously it's going to be right. outrageous, but this outrageous reaction to, it's a military magazine. And explain to people a little bit what happens in that moment. Is that the pivotal moment? Is that the turning point for him, or had he already sort of?
It's a key point for him. So Svengoolie was raised basically in poverty. His parents were from Niger. They'd gone to Saudi Arabia to make pilgrimage. And they stayed, and they basically were just indentured servants in Saudi Arabia. And there's a lot of racism against Africans in Saudi Arabia.
Can I just jump in? This is a part of the book that was educational for me in terms of that sort of class structure. I mean, I understand that it exists everywhere, but like the level of sort of disparity and
oh, yeah.
the way the blacks were treated was pretty eye-opening. Like,
there was racism against Svengoolie at the terrorist training camps. And Svengoolie was, you know, very black, from Niger.
Which, by the way, blew my mind. Like,
yeah.
Terrorists. Racist. Yeah. Like, wait, it seems a little like...
His nickname means the white rose in Pashto. That's what Svengoolie means, the white rose in Pashto. And they're calling him that because he was so dark. So, I mean, it's that kind of humor, if you can call it that. Anyway, so he... In the 90s in Saudi Arabia, he is raised on the legendary stories of holy warriors, mujahideen, who are you know, defeating the Soviets in Afghanistan, who are fighting the Russians in Chechnya. And so he is, you know, these people, these legendary Mujahideen are like what you and I were raised thinking about sports heroes, right? And actors or whatever.
Yeah.
And so at one point, somebody shows him this magazine and he says, we should get this. And this is pre-9/11, as you note. We should get a plane and fly it into the Pentagon. I think there was an image of the Pentagon in the magazine, also an image of a plane. And from that, he is recruited to a local Al-Qaeda recruiter. This is before 9/11, and he flies to Pakistan and he gets hooked up, and all of a sudden he's training at the Al-Farouq terrorist training camp in Afghanistan. Again, before 9/11, he hears about 9/11 while he is there in that part of the world, being trained to be a terrorist. And they don't know what they're going to attack, who they're going to attack. At that point, obviously, the attack on the USS Cole has happened in 2000, the attack on the US embassies in Kenya and Tanzania has happened. So it's not like the U.S. has not been a target, but at that point, it could really be anybody. But, then 9/11 happens, and then the U.S. comes to Afghanistan. They don't have to go to the U.S. The U.S. comes to Afghanistan, and that's why he goes into Afghanistan and engages in that ambush against the U.S.
It's that sports hero analogy. It's almost like they would have trading cards of terrorists 100%. That they look up to, the way a kid would have an Aaron Judge trading card. 100%.
And in fact, let me tell you something. So people often ask me, like, why did Spin Gul confess? Like, why was he so eager to tell his story when he was picked up on that boat? And there are a couple of reasons, I think. One is he had just been like in a Libyan prison, tortured for like 5 years. So I think his mind wasn't 100%. But second, and this is a story that Dave Bitkauer, one of the prosecutors, told me. Dave Bitkauer went to Yale. And when he was at Yale, he got a chance to interview Ron Darling, the legendary Mets pitcher.
Yeah,
Ron Darling had helped win the 86 World Series. He's a huge figure in baseball. But Bitkauer wanted to ask him about when he was at Yale, when he pitched a no-hitter. And Ron Darling remembered every detail of that day when he pitched a no-hitter, even though he had gone on to do such bigger, greater things. He remembered the no-hitter. And to Bitkauer, Spin Gul confessing and telling his story was like Ron Darling telling his story.
This is
the best day of this guy's life, telling about his career in terrorism.
He's got to get it out.
Yeah, he wants to tell everybody.
And especially if you consider his background, what he comes from nothing, indentured servitude, essentially. This is his moment. And there's no one to go, maybe you should nix some of that.
In fact, when he's picked up,
you got to hear this. Then I went over and did like, he's going crazy.
He wants to tell everybody when an Italian Green Beret asks him about how he got the bullet scar on his arm when he in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea in 2011, he's on a refugee boat. And Spin Gul's very eager for everyone to know he does not belong with these refugees. He is with Al-Qaeda. He's a much bigger deal. So that's part of it also.
You talk about civilian court and trying this in civilian court versus Gitmo. And you said in a recent interview that you think America would have been less safe if it had been tried in Gitmo. And in fact, he was asking to be tried in Gitmo.
Yeah. Well, he wanted to be tried at The Hague. He thought he was such a big deal. He should be going to the International Criminal Court. Yeah.
Explain to folks a little bit why the civilian court was sort of it was almost in a way a watershed moment in terrorist prosecution, but why Gitmo would not have been as good an option for all of us.
So this is Spin Gul to this day is the only foreign terrorist tried in a U.S. criminal court for killing U.S. service members abroad. It had never happened before, and it has not yet happened since, although there's going to be another attempt to do it with one of the conspirators from the Abbey Gate bombing. That guy, a terrorist named Jafar, is in a prison in a jail in Virginia right now. I don't really have a position theoretically on which is better, a criminal court or a military tribunal, but I will say that criminal courts at this point have successfully prosecuted more than 600 terrorists, and the military courts, the military tribunal set up after 9/11, have only resulted in two convictions and 9 plea deals. And so it hasn't really been hugely successful. And it's completely speculation, but I think if Spingool had been picked up 3 years earlier during the Bush years, he would have been sent to Gitmo. And I think it's very likely that ultimately he would have been freed. And the reason I think that is because there wouldn't have been this intense investigation and this accumulation of evidence against him. And theoretically, in this, you know, in this very speculative Earth 2 that I'm talking about, Spingool, like 10 years into it, they're trying to empty it out. Somebody would have said, well, we don't even have any evidence on this guy. He just says he did this. We don't even know if it's true. And they would have just shipped him out to Niger or Saudi Arabia or wherever. And then he would have gone and tried to kill as many Americans as possible, because that's right. His life's mission. So I just think that this doesn't spoil the book, but because Spingool is now in a supermax for the rest of his life, I think that that makes us safer than what probably would have happened if he had just been sent to Gitmo, because they're really making an effort. The government's making an effort to get rid of these people as much as possible. I think there are only like 15 left, and they'll probably never leave.
Just as we wrap up, that leads into something I wanted to ask you about: the approach on terror, the Bush administration versus Obama versus Trump, and just touch on that a little bit for a moment for folks from your perspective and your experience and research.
I think right now we're kind of like in a consensus place where Gitmo has remained closed, even though to terrorists, even though, Trump has, you know, there were 4 years of Trump and there's another 9 months of Trump and he has not reopened it to terrorists. And I think that we're kind of like in a place where there is this consensus view. It's not Bush. It's not Obama. It's its own middle ground. When Obama tried to bring Spingool over for prosecution in the criminal court, it was hugely controversial. People did not want it to happen. Politicians acted as if he and other terrorists that they wanted to bring from abroad, they acted almost as if they were like, you know, imbued with these like superhuman powers, like Thanos, and would be able to like come into Manhattan and easily escape from prison and kill people. But when Trump earlier this year announced that they had captured one of the guys from Abbey Gate and they were bringing him to the U.S. for prosecution, there was not even any reaction. So I think that there has been some consensus view that trying these guys in criminal court, if a case can be made, actually is a good idea. And that's why the Spingool case was so important and so radical for its time.
Well, it's great to have you on. Absolutely terrific book. It's a great read. You learn a lot. Another time, maybe we'll talk about just the terrorist training is pretty exhaustive and intense. It's amazing.
Very much.
The book is Race Against Terror, Chasing Al-Qaeda, Killer at the Dawn of the Forever War. Jake, great to have you, and enjoy all of your work on CNN. Keep up the good work. It's great to have you on. It's good to see you at The Late Show recently. We'll talk soon.
Sounds great, Paul. Thank you so much.
There you go. That's Jake Tapper. Really great book. Great read. And again, follow me on social at Paul Mercurio. And December 12th and 13th, House of Comedy in Scottsdale, Arizona. February 11th to the 14th, Comedy Castle in Royal Oak, Michigan, and other dates coming as well. Go to my website, paulmercurio.com. All right, thanks for checking out the podcast, everybody.